supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Malcolm Kenyatta is poised to make history after winning the Democratic nomination for state representative in North Philadelphia during last week's primary. Given the city's Democratic registration edge, Kenyatta is favored to become the first openly gay legislator of color in Harrisburg. But he says voters are more concerned about the issues, not his sexual orientation, despite the homophobic attacks he endured during his campaign. Keystone Crossroads' Annette John Hall reports.
Malcolm Kenyatta dismissed the homophobic flyers plastered throughout his district on Election Day as petty politics. He says what voters really care about are quality candidates who speak about the issues that impact them, like higher wages, quality public schools, and affordable housing.
We have to pick the best candidate, not because of or in spite of how they worship, where they're from, or who they love. And I think that that is the clear, resounding message that came out of this election.
Black voters make up more than half of Kenyatta's district. He won it handily, despite the fact there has been less support for LGBTQ rights among African Americans. Only 39% of black voters favor gay marriage. Heath Fogg Davis is a political scientist at Temple. He says that number is up from 29% a decade ago. And he says Kenyatta's political agenda, coupled with his identity, reflects an intersectionality that speaks to black LGBTQ voters.
I think it was very politically savvy, but also I think it makes practical kind of moral sense to talk about the ways that these issues impact different members of the black community in different ways.
Kenyatta will take on Republican Milton Street, who ran unopposed, in the general election in November. Annette John Hall, Keystone Crossroads.
The Camden County Jail just started a new program for inmates who have mental health and addiction issues. Jail officials connect them with case managers while they're in jail and, importantly, connect them to services once they've been released. WHYY's Nina Feldman visited the jail to find out more.
When I met William Rivera, it was the last day of his 8.5-month stint in Camden County Jail. Rivera was in for a burglary charge. He says he stole to support his heroin addiction. This was not his first time in jail.
I've been incarcerated since I was young, since I was 10 years old. Yeah, I've been through foster homes. I've been through placements. I've been through, like, you know, prisons, back and forth.
If you had to guess how many times you've been in and out of jail or prison, how many times would you guess?
Were you talking about adult or is it juvenile?
Total.
I'm going to say, like, 40, 50 times. Like going back and forth thing, yeah.
But this time, something's different. For the past few weeks, Rivera has been working with a reentry specialist who's helped him figure out what he needs to succeed once he's out of jail.
They got me my ID to help you for, you know, to have a job. You know, they help you for everything that you need to be in the society.
There's no reason to wait until they're released to identify, oh, you don't have a birth certificate, you don't have photo identification, which all adds up.
That's Sharon Bean. She's the population manager at the jail. She leads the program, which is funded by a 3-year, $650,000 grant from the Department of Justice. Reentry programs have gained support in prisons nationwide, but they're less common in local jails. Bean says in this program, the help starts inside.
The idea is the next appointment is already scheduled before they're released.
To make this work, the agencies serving inmates once they're released need to talk to each other. That means medical groups, educational institutions, and housing agencies in Camden are all in touch about the same clients.
You can think of a relay race where the baton is passed and people run a leg to provide that service.
That's David Owens, director of the Camden Department of Corrections, chiming in with Bean. She says there will be a reentry specialist literally at the door of the prison as each person is released.
And whatever was the first thing that was identified, if it's housing, they're connecting them to housing and making sure they have a place to stay tonight. And then there's a plan for what are you doing tomorrow?
For William Rivera, the plan is to attend Narcotics Anonymous meetings, start the job he has lined up at a butcher shop, and reconnect with his fiancée. The city of Camden has limited addiction resources. Its needle exchange program was closed in 2016, and the methadone clinic, though still open, was recently raided by the FBI. David Owen says about 20% of inmates in Camden County jails have mental illness, and 60% have substance use disorder. People who deal with both often end up cycling in and out of jail.
We don't know whether it is the drugs driving the mental health or the mental health driving the drugs. And with programs like this, we're able to devote some time to finding that out.
The plan is to serve about 190 people each year through the program. Since it began in March, reentry specialists have worked with about 30 inmates. Three have been released and are working with the program on the outside. Rivera is number four. When we packed up and said goodbye, everybody around, a lieutenant, a sergeant, the jail's population manager, were all rooting for him.
All right, good luck to you, man. Yo, you can do it. All right? All right.
Good luck.
Nina Feldman, WHYY News.
New Jersey lawmakers are considering legislation affecting a growing body of workers known as freelancers. Let's focus on the gig economy with Breeshan Rogers, associate professor at Temple's Beasley School of Law. Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Happy to be here.
Let's talk about this burgeoning work sector. To what extent is it growing in the country at large?
Freelancing itself isn't new, and you know what a lot of people call independent contracting isn't new, but they are certainly growing as a percentage of the workforce. Independent contracting, especially at the lower end of the sort of skill distribution for less skilled workers, and then freelancers for more skilled workers.
Is that the only distinction, or are there other ways to parse those two terms?
I'm not sure there's a legal distinction between a freelancer and an independent contractor. The main distinction is between an employee and an independent contractor. And that's very important. If you're an employee, you know, you're entitled to minimum wage, to overtime pay, to collective bargaining, to unemployment insurance, you know, to healthcare coverage. If you're an independent contractor, you typically don't get any of those protections. Now, freelancers are legally independent contractors, at least most of the time. And so they typically don't have those types of protections.
And so let's look at this legislation. What protections are being considered?
One of the most common complaints from freelancers is that they don't always get paid on time. So they may enter into a contract and then they have to fight for a while to actually get their payment after they've completed the work. So what this bill does is it basically requires that freelancers get paid on time, within 30 days after the work is completed for jobs over $600.
And then what teeth are in the provision?
So it allows freelancers to go into court to enforce their rights. Most importantly, I think it provides for liquidated damages. So basically, if a company hires a freelancer then doesn't pay them quickly, then the state can order that company to pay them both what they're owed and then a amount of damages equal to 100% of what they're owed, basically double what they were required to pay in the first place. And it also prohibits companies from retaliating against freelancers, which is quite important.
Now, you did note that obviously freelancers and independent contractors have the option to go to court. But as a practical matter, if they are, say, due pay in 30 days and it gets to 45 days, are they really going to retain an attorney and go that path?
There's also an administrative process, so the state itself will take up prosecution of this. So freelancers can complain to a state agency, and then the agency can basically do this on their behalf, collect on their behalf. So that should save them legal fees and make it easier to enforce their rights.
Do you see this measure, should it get all the way to the governor's desk and then become law, as a halfway measure, or does it really go a large way towards solving this issue?
I think it goes a long way towards solving the issue of freelancers not being paid on time. You know, there are much bigger issues in the economy in New Jersey and around the country around independent contracting and just the kind of, you know, declining wages and declining working conditions for low-wage workers. You know, one thing I'll mention in that regard, the city of Seattle passed legislation that basically enabled Uber drivers and Lyft drivers to unionize. That legislation was necessary because if the drivers are legally independent contractors, then they're not covered under federal labor law. The Ninth Circuit, which is the federal circuit court covering Seattle, decided last week or the week before that the legislation wasn't preempted by the NLRA, meaning that, you know, states could pass that legislation, though they thought that there might be some antitrust problems with Seattle's version of it. In any event, if New Jersey wanted to get very aggressive about this type of this set of questions, they could. It seems like the upshot of that decision is that the state could give independent contractors, such as Uber drivers, the right to collectively bargain under state law, and that would do a tremendous amount to improve workers' working conditions. The other thing that's evolving is that many states have been under pressure from. As a result of lawsuits from Uber drivers and other gig economy workers, they've been taking a look at their definitions of employment under state law. And California just took the step of changing their definition of employment in a way that's very likely to cover Uber drivers, other independent contractors, and potentially many, many freelancers as well.
Professor Rogers, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Again, happy to be here.
Professor Breishan Rogers, Associate Professor at Temple's Beasley School of Law. A local man and a refugee from the Congo have started a fashion line in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Their friendship is one of the many signs of how welcome newcomers are in what's being dubbed the refugee capital of the United States. But as federal policy changes, few refugees are arriving, even though Lancaster's doors are open. WHYY's Kyrie Greenberg reports.
Brian Norris is a fashion designer who moved back to Lancaster to take care of his parents a few years ago. After meeting Amish and Mennonite craftsmen, he started a small line of handmade clothing called Forager Company, and they found a market online.
I am a lucky person in that I am connected on Instagram. I have friends in New York. My background is men's fashion, so I have some connections which can at least give me the faith. Because they're showing up and saying, I love what you're doing. I want to buy a jacket.
Around the same time, Remy Kasongo moved to Lancaster with his wife, Angela, and five of their children. They lived in a refugee camp in Zambia called Maheba for 14 years after fleeing civil war in northern Congo. Remy would leave Angela and the kids in Maheba for a month at a time to work in a neighboring town.
In the camp, you would just like sneak, but get a letter that would help you to get out of the camp. And he would go to start looking for jobs. And then he met one Indian guy, and that guy gave him the job to do overalls.
The Refugee Makers Project began when Norris gave a talk to a local sewing group. Kasongo agreed to sew a line of tote bags for the Brooklyn Museum in Norris's living room. They sold quickly, but the money wasn't enough to live on. At the time, Kasongo was working at a chicken processing plant, which was hard on his health. Norris remembers the toll it took on him.
I can't see my friend working like that, you know, when we can do this if we work hard. So it was my call to action.
After raising over $20,000 online, the workshop moved to the Keystone Art and Culture Center. The duo sells upcycled military jackets and thrifted clothing that Norris dyes indigo and Kasongo embellishes with African wax print cutouts. Norris says he wants to keep the project small and focus on Kasongo's salary. And Norris says at 60, he's found a new purpose.
When it was just me, being dysfunctional, erratic, and spontaneous was okay. Now that it extends to a refugee and his family, I need to step up to the table, which is really great. It motivates me. My thing is I want to be a good little company, not a big company.
The custom pieces are a little expensive for Lancaster and sell mostly online. But Norris tapped his contacts in fashion to get their work into high-end pop-up markets.
I think you're the boss. You three. I want the fit models comments because they got to move.
Norris gives Kasongo rides to work and English classes three times a week. The workshop is homey. Kasongo's 9-year-old son, Juma, comes by for a snack and to play the piano. Kasongo says he feels lucky to return to his original trade.
He said that I can say this is God's direction for me to do this work because a lot of people had said whatever you do in Africa, when you go to America, you will not do the same. And then he found this American guy who is very good, who is helping him.
Lancaster got the nickname Refugee Capital of America last year because it had accepted more than 1,300 people in 4 years, 20 times more people per capita than the rest of the U.S. Stephanie Gromick says she saw a change in mid-2015, the time both Kasongo and Norris moved to Lancaster. She's with Church World Service, one of 19 Pennsylvania nonprofits that resettles refugees.
The support for refugees was always there, but definitely in the past 3-4 years, the community support has just skyrocketed.
That year, the majority of refugees resettling in Pennsylvania were from Bhutan or the Democratic Republic of Congo, but she attributes it to growing media attention around the Syrian refugee crisis. Her agency has 11 programs that provide 5 years of services for refugees who might have been judges, teachers, or farmers back home. The program helps, but she says nothing compares to making a friend.
Ryan's a fashion guy, and Remy is this fashion guy, and now they're creating this entire fashion line, and I feel like that's just a really great analogy for what we've been working on in the community to build.
Yet changes to federal policy have cut the number of new arrivals. Last year, Church World Service had about 90 refugees that were scheduled but never arrived. Gromick attributes the cancellations to 2017's 4 executive orders, which include the travel bans and a 3-month suspension of the resettlement program. The delays also meant the security and medical clearances they had obtained expired, which effectively restarts the years-long refugee application process. Halfway through the fiscal year on March 31st, the Office of Resettlement reported accepting 10,000 refugees to the U.S. That's less than 1/4 of the 45,000-person quota set by President Trump. The Kasongos have 2 adult children who are still in Mahaba with their families. The camp has been around since the 70s, but they feel there's little hope in the refugee system right now. So the family asked Norris if he could sponsor them.
And there's really nothing that I can do to sponsor a family. And to have to say, I can't help, I mean, that's a tough one.
Gromick says Church World Service and other resettlement agencies can relate.
We are here to provide hope to these individuals who are facing unimaginable situations, and we can't do that right now because of a bunch of red tape and nonsense that's happening in D.C., you know? It's very frustrating.
For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
Life is just a short period of time in which you are alive. That's a quote from novelist Philip Roth's book, American Pastoral. The acclaimed writer who passed yesterday accomplished a lot in his lifetime, much of which was spent in Newark, New Jersey. And indeed, the Newark Public Library will come into his collection. Joining me with more is Dr. Rosemary Steinbaum, a trustee of the Newark Public Library. Dr. Steinbaum, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for calling me.
Describe your work with Philip Roth.
Well, I have had the pleasure of working with Mr. Roth over several years, but from the point of view of the library, 5 years ago, we mounted a photo exhibition called Philip Roth and a Lifetime in Photographs. And I had the great opportunity to sit with Mr. Roth in his apartment in New York, surrounded by boxes of his own family photographs. And together we selected photographs that told the story of his life on the one hand, but also told the story of his life in Newark and the story of Newark itself.
And what a collector. Some 3,500 volumes will be coming into the library system. Where will they be accommodated?
We have a large space at the moment that's a storage space. And he has seen and approved the space. We worked with an architect to develop drawings that will accommodate his collection. It's located on the second floor of the library in a very prominent location next to what was our main reading room. You know, the way I envision this library, I myself am a literary traveler. When I was in the South, I went to Oxford, Mississippi to go to Faulkner's house. You know, I've been to Twain's house. As a person who reads, I like to visit venues that the people I read have inhabited. We're going to recreate that venue with some of Roth's furniture, his standing writing desk, his Parsons table, his Eames chairs. He's also bequeathed some of his collection, baseball posters and so forth. So it really will be a space to inhabit the space that was Roth, not just to access his books.
Many of his books are described as semi-autobiographical in nature, some relying on his alter ego, Nathan Zuckerman. Describe the Newark, New Jersey of his youth, which I'm sure is much different than that of 2018.
He grew up in the mostly Jewish neighborhood of Weequahic. It was a working and middle class neighborhood. He describes bike rides to his local library branch, where he took out the baseball novels of Tunis and other novelists, Howard Fast, that he cared about as he was growing up in those days. And you see that both in his little autobiographical work called The Facts, he refers to that background, and in his last novel called Nemesis, the kids from Weequahic all hang out in the neighborhood school playground in the summer, and that is also a reflection of Philip Roth's own youth.
Roth, in his later days, wondered about the viability of the novel as a form of work. How is your library used now, and what is the intent of bringing his collection to the Newark Library? What is its role in the community?
That's a complicated and wonderful question. Our library does many, many things in the area of services for the Newark community, programs for the Newark community, outreach. You know, we have knitting and crocheting clubs, book clubs, teen groups, mommy and me groups, many, many kinds of activities that do not seem on the surface to be directly connected to the Philip Roth personal library. But Philip Roth himself became a young writer by first being a young reader and discovering the joys of literature sitting in the stacks of the Newark Public Library. And it's very much our intention to promote young readers and young writers who can grow into the next generation's brilliant tellers of the American story, the way we had in Roth.
Dr. Steinbaum, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Rosemary Steinbaum is a trustee of the Newark Public Library. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.